Want to buy a middle school? For cheap? That's what the Board of Education of the Scioto Valley Local School District of Scioto County, Ohio, want to know, because they have placed the infamous Zahn's Corner Middle School up for sale. Why infamous? That's the school just 3 miles downwind of the defunct and in the middle of being demolished by EPA Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, known as PORTS. The facility enriched uranium for U.S. nuclear weapons and is highly radioactive. It was the site of radioactive contamination discovered in air ducts at Zahn's Corner, which closed the school to be shut down and abandoned in 2019. However, the local school board, hoping for short-term memory loss and or full-blown nuclear amnesia, has engaged a local realtor to offer this property in the most glowing terms, calling it a great investment opportunity, having unlimited potential. And only a few paragraphs down, sneaking in a generic disclaimer, they write, "This property sold in as-is condition," without mentioning what the as-is is. Radioactivity. It takes a world-famous researcher, the man who uncovered the original contamination at Zahn's Corner, to explain the problems for anyone even thinking of purchasing this site. And when he tells you,
"If I look at a purchaser of this school, I'd say, well, okay, you can go in there today and it's all fine. You know, DOE is not doing anything there. But if Johnny and Janie are in there going to school and this is 2028 and the wind's blowing while they're demolitioning the 333 building and the centrifuge plant is fired up and they're cutting open DUF6 cylinders and the wind is blowing right towards Zahn's, parents, I can't guarantee anything about what your kids are going to breathe. That's the problem with this location."
And there are so many more. Well, when Dr. Michael Ketterer, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Northern Arizona University, and formerly with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Enforcement, tells you the truth about not only Zahn's Corner, but the radioactive nature of the water, land, air, and plants within a 10 to 15 mile radius of the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant site, you would be well advised to do whatever you can to protect yourself and your family from this horrific outpost of that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we follow up on the story of what's happening in southern Ohio with radioactive contamination from the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, otherwise known as PORTS, and its impact on the safety of the water, air, land, and plants that are grown in the area, with an extensive conversation with Dr. Michael Ketterer. He is Professor Emeritus, Chemistry and Biochemistry at Northern Arizona University, and is something of a researcher at large, delving into nuclear contamination issues around the country and giving us the facts the EPA would rather we not know. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than has yet been discussed in our suddenly changed presidential election race. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting here in the U.S., where this entire story deserves to be under the label numbnuts. 3 Mile Island, the dormant power plant renowned as the site of the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history, may be switched back on, driven in part by the ravenous energy appetites of artificial intelligence developers. It's part of a broader push, backed by the Biden White House, to bring mothballed nuclear facilities back to life, something that has never before been done in this country. Owner Constellation Energy is laying the groundwork for a recommissioning, with recent tests at 3 Mile Island's dormant Unit 1 reactor. Shut down in 2019, Unit 1 sits next to the former Unit 2 reactor that melted down 45 years ago. Constellation Energy CEO Joe Dominguez said, "We've found the plant is in pretty good shape. We think it is technically feasible to restart it." Not so fast, Bubba. Safety concerns, supply chain issues, and engineering challenges have thrown projects off schedule and over budget repeatedly in dealing with nuclear. At the Vogtle nuclear facility in Georgia, the first new reactors in the United States since 2016 recently came online. 7 years late, and nearly $20 billion with a B dollars over budget. An effort to build a similar reactor in South Carolina collapsed. As for the rush to revive and extend the life of nuclear plants, the worry is that regulators are being pressured to overlook potential safety hazards, which could be caused by resuscitating equipment that in some cases predates the Carter administration, which ended in 1981, almost 43 years ago. Edwin Lyman, director of nuclear power safety at the Union of Concerned Scientists, says the United States is, quote, "taking our aging reactors into uncharted territory, cutting corners on nuclear safety and increasing the risk of a Fukushima disaster in the U.S. is not likely to be a winning strategy for enhancing public confidence in the technology." But of course, they're going to push forward and try to get away with it anyway. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Well, the good news is that for the first time since 2021, the United States has declassified its nuclear weapons stockpile inventory numbers. The latest information was published by the National Nuclear Security Administration, and the standout figure is the overall total of nuclear warheads in the U.S. stockpile. Are you ready for this? 3,748 nuclear weapons as of September 2023. Now, to put that in perspective, consider the atomic bomb blast that happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In each instance, it was only one bomb, and they were pint size compared to our current bombs. Only 15 or 20 kilotons each. But you've seen the pictures. You know the story. One bomb each flattened those two cities. Between them killed 200,000 people, and the health and fertility impacts continue on to the children, grandchildren, and now great-grandchildren of the original survivors, the Hibakusha. That was just one bomb in each city. And now we're looking at the U.S. having 3,748 of them, and each one is magnitudes larger and more powerful than those two bombs in Japan 79 years ago. If you're wondering why there seems to be no money for the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or infrastructure in this country, or universal health care, or easier access to higher education, all those good things, you wonder where the money went for that? Look at the nuclear stockpile. And now they are building more. So to the warmongering brainiacs who think that more and more nuclear weapons will make us safer, when they most assuredly will not. You and all those bombs are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
And we will link to an article from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Humans should teach AI how to avoid nuclear war while they still can. Ya think? Internationally, Russia does not rule out new deployments of nuclear missiles in response to the planned U.S. stationing of long-range conventional weapons in Germany. The U.S. said last week it would start deployment in Germany starting in 2026 of weapons that will include SM-6, Tomahawk, and new hypersonic missiles in order to demonstrate its commitment to NATO and European defense. Russian President Vladimir Putin said last month that Moscow would resume producing short and intermediate-range land-based missiles and decide where to place them if needed. Most of Russia's missile systems are capable of being fitted with either conventional or nuclear warheads. The missiles that both countries are contemplating deploying are intermediate-range ground-based weapons that were banned under a 1987 U.S.-Soviet treaty. The U.S. quit the treaty in 2019 during the administration of Donald Trump, accusing Russia of violations that Moscow denied. Experts pointed out that Russia could deploy missiles in Chukotka, in the Far East, from where they could target Alaska or even California. Good times. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, nuclear kills two ways. Fast by blast, slow by glow. The glow being radiation. We've all been conditioned to think of nuclear dangers to just those of the bomb. The fireball, intense heat, mushroom cloud. But ongoing danger comes from the release of ionizing nuclear radiation into the environment, and that's what creates the greatest nuclear risk to our health, safety, and our DNA. There's a steady release of radiation around the country, from uranium mining sites, uranium refinement, manufacture of weapons and reactor fuel rods, reactor operations, accidents, intentional dumping of radioactive tritium-contaminated water into the Pacific, and then there's the forever dangers of used nuclear fuel that is dangerously radioactive for 250,000 years, and there's still no place safe to put it. All of this creates ongoing, ever-increasing nuclear risks to the health and safety of people and the environment. And this is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We don't mess around. Every week, we get to nuclear stories with facts, continuity, and context, providing you with a much deeper and nuanced telling than you would ever expect to find on mainstream media. Go to our website, search any nuclear topic. You will find news, interviews, and links to articles ranging back more than 13 years. But to continue to do this work, we need your help. The show runs on donations, and without them, without you, we can't survive. So please help us out with a donation of any size, be it one time, or you can set up a recurring donation of as little as $5 a month. We really count on those $5 donations to keep us going. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. And it's easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the donate button. If you prefer and have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Hit the pause button here and go donate now. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Dr. Michael Ketterer has a PhD in analytical chemistry and has worked for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Enforcement. Since 2000, Michael has been conducting studies of plutonium in the environment, publishing and lecturing extensively, and has analyzed samples from locations worldwide. He is currently studying plutonium dioxide particles in the soils near the former Rocky Flats facility in Colorado and fingerprinting off-site contaminants near the former Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in southern Ohio. And that's what we will be talking about today. Michael Ketterer is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Northern Arizona University, and we spoke on July 22, 2024. Dr. Michael Ketterer, it is always great to have you back here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
It seems like every time there's a story of radiological contamination in the area around the defunct Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant near Piketon, Ohio, you are in the news somewhere in the center of that story. How did you become involved with working in this area, and what kind of expertise do you bring to it?
My work in Southern Ohio near the former Portsmouth Uranium Enrichment Plant, that's a government-owned plant. My work got started in 2018 when I had recently, I'll use the word retired, but put it in quotes, I left my position as a professor, full-time professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Metropolitan State University of Denver, and I became an emeritus. I had worked the longest time and done the best professional stuff at Northern Arizona University, and they said, "We're glad to have you as an emeritus starting in 2018." And then I said to myself, "Well, I'm only age 58. What am I going to redirect my career into doing?" So I liked nuclear forensics. I liked measuring isotopes and measuring things with mass spectrometry. And I had already been working on environmental sources and fingerprinting of elements like uranium and plutonium. And I still do. And I said, you know, I want to do some things that have some meaning and purpose, and I want to study environmental contamination, and in particular at former US nuclear sites. And I remember the words of my late parents, which were they were Ohio residents for 40 plus years. And they both said, "Hey, you know," because I told them, would tell them a lot about the line of work that I do. And they said, "Hey, go find some stuff in Ohio. Go find some stuff in Ohio." And that didn't really click in my brain until after my father's death. And so about 2018, September or so, I had some business associated with my father's estate to go to Ohio, in this case, Summit County in Northeast Ohio. And while I was there, I rented a car and I said, "I'm going to stay a bit extra. I'm going to drive down to this Portsmouth place," which I had been reading about. And I said, "You know, this is really a Stalinistic nightmare, environmental nightmare from what I can see." And that's even just from reading the Department of Energy's perspective in their annual site environmental monitoring report. So in September of 2018, I took some first set of samples, unobserved types of samples. I analyzed them. I said to myself, "Wow, there's a lot of soil contamination, water contamination, and so on. And it looks like uranium, enriched uranium specifically, and neptunium-237 and plutonium were the three things that I was able to measure from that first set of nine or so September 2018 samples."
And what kind of samples did you actually collect?
Water from Little Beaver Creek, Big Beaver Creek. These are in areas that, you know, I had researched and knew where the plant's drainage was, what would likely be affected, what had DOE already tested. So basically that and sediments from the creek and soils from various areas, mostly to the east of the plant in the, you know, I'll call it the countryside. All of this is off-site, not on Department of Energy property. And let me make clear to anybody who's listening, I do not ever go on Department of Energy property, probably not with an invitation, but all of the sampling and studies that I do is all on stuff that has kind of left the site boundaries.
When you found that there were these radionuclides in the material that you had collected, what was your next step after that? Did you talk with people? Did you make an announcement? Did you go back to do more work? What was next?
The next thing that I did was I said, "I'm really sitting on something that's a powder keg of environmental contamination." And it appears from reading the DOE reports and also from reading the pulse of the community. I'm not a user of social media, but I read stuff on Facebook. And if somebody has a public site, that helps me learn about what is a community thinking. And the community usually knows what's going on. So I looked through all of this stuff, and in fall of 2018, I made a connection by email with a person named Elizabeth Lamerson, who's a local resident. And Elizabeth started going and taking environmental samples, and she sent several packages of environmental samples to me. And that kind of expanded upon this initial set of eight, nine of my own samples. You know, we had tested 50 to 100 samples. I had a reasonable set of samples, and Elizabeth and I were in communication regarding where they're all from. And I now had sort of an understanding, having been there, I had an understanding where everything was. So I was completely quiet about what was going on. And but then that culminated in, on April 27th, 2019, Elizabeth coordinated with Matt Brewster, who's the Pike County Health Coordinator, essentially. He arranged a meeting, public meeting, at Pike General Health property, essentially to talk with the community about the recent, and this is going back to April of 2019, DOE had just prior to that announced that neptunium had been detected in the Zahn's Corner A41A air monitor. And so the community was in a big uproar, and the community went into this meeting expecting to beat up DOE about that air monitoring result. So Jeremy Davis from DOE was there, and he addressed the community. This is all on YouTube. Elizabeth made arrangements for me to present the results publicly at the same meeting that DOE was addressing the community. In other words, a setup for an ambush of DOE. And DOE walked into that meeting unprepared and didn't know what was to be presented to them. And essentially, my results instantly told the community everything DOE was saying about provenance, where does stuff come from, is a lie.
And were you there physically at the meeting, or was this Zoom?
This was the year before the pandemic. So it's kind of in the pre-Zoom era, and I was on a speakerphone. I was ambushing them, speaking on a speakerphone, telling them with each slide, this is what I found. This is the neptunium from you that's in Little Beaver Creek. This is the contamination. And I didn't ever say Zahn's, but Elizabeth and I worked out. She worked out the language. Just say it's a local middle school and everybody will know what that means. I believe I said something to that effect in the report and at the meeting. And at that meeting, I said many things. You know, I confronted DOE about the neptunium lie in the air, but I also revealed that in wipe samples that Elizabeth Lamerson had collected, we had found enriched uranium in those wipe samples that were taken from the attic at Zahn's Corner. Elizabeth knew somebody that worked there and secured access, and on two separate occasions took two separate sets of samples from the attic, which I tested, you know, as two separate pieces of lab work. We had concluded that there is indeed enriched uranium present in the attic. And then, so then I said that publicly, and that led to mid-May 2019, the school board made the decision to close Zahn's, and then DOE panicked and sent in Savannah River National Laboratory under the behest of DOE Environmental Management, go in there and sample. And they basically bullied the community on Memorial Day weekend 2019 into taking a set of samples. However, I got splits of those samples from Matt Brewster, and I found that, yes, indeed, there's enriched uranium here.
So at what point was the school actually closed down as a result of this contamination?
I made these statements publicly on April 27th, and there was a lot of discussion at the community level. And I think it was something like May 13th, 2019, the school board made the announcement. And it was a week or so before the school year was going to close anyway. And they said, we are discontinuing the school year early for the entire district, and we are permanently closing Zahn's Corner. And basically, they quarantined the school to the point where all the materials, books and teaching materials and so on, were all left in the school.
So we'll loop around back to the most recent news about Zahn's Corner, but I want to talk about the most recent story that has come out, which had to do with your testing of the water in Little Beaver Creek and the land around there and the plants. What was this study and what inspired it, or what motivated you to do this aspect of the research?
I'm testing the water in Little Beaver Creek because since September 2018 or so, with some of my first samples in test tubes that I carried back on the plane with me, I've known that there's enriched uranium and other contaminants in this creek water. It wasn't until 2021 that I made the effort to measure neptunium-237. In the creek water. And neptunium-237 Let me tell our listeners a little bit about what this is. It's a mostly synthetic isotope. It's associated with nuclear explosions and it's synthesized in nuclear reactors. It was a contaminant in the uranium that went into the Portsmouth plant, and it's known that it was a contaminant. And that's why it was in the air in the Zond's Corner monitor, and it was in the creek, in the sediments of the creek. It's there for a reason, and I believe we've talked a lot about that on these previous episodes as well. But it wasn't until 2021 that I made the effort to measure neptunium-237 in the water. We have to do some evaporation and chemical pre-concentration of the neptunium. But since then, I've tested, I don't know, six or seven different samples of water from Little Beaver Creek and Big Beaver Creek. And Little Beaver Creek drains the north portion of the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant site, and it includes the area where a lot of the neptunium was introduced. And this is documented in DOE things from the 70s. This includes the area where the high concentrations of neptunium and plutonium were present on the site, and then this all drained and infected the Little Beaver Creek. I have some documents, and I think we've talked about this from 76 and 77. They came from Vina Colley, and Bobby Vaughn is another individual in the community that's given me this kind of stuff. But it shows the paper trail of, oh, fudge, we have a big neptunium problem right here. So I've been detecting neptunium. It's present at relatively low levels, and you can detect it. But it's in the water, and it's in this contaminated zone. So in March of this past year, I went to the Little Beaver Creek, Big Beaver Creek confluence, and I coordinated with Vina Colley and with Lee Blackburn. And Vina's group is called PRESS, and Lee is with Ohio Nuclear Free Network. And we spent a couple of afternoons in this area where Little Beaver Creek, the source of the contamination, blends with a larger waterway, Big Beaver Creek, and then from there it goes to the Scioto River.
How far away is that site from the actual port site, Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion site?
Either as the crow flies or in creek miles, it's on the order of a mile, something like that. It's very close. And I should add that, in September of 2018, I had already seen what DOE had in their reports. You have to kind of decipher what they're saying, and they do their best to hide the signatures. I'll call it the signatures, any way that you could prove where this stuff came from. They do their best to hide that in their reporting their data. But I still knew about the neptunium before I got there. So I sampled with Lee and Vina, and we were joined for part of the time by Cincinnati WKRC Channel 12.
Is that Dwayne Pullman?
Dwayne Pullman, senior investigative reporter. We were joined by him part of the time, and then Dwayne recently reported a story. We collected samples of plant material and sediments and water. To date, and this is March, so the lab work is far away from finished, but I've got some fairly solid results now on neptunium in all of these media, soil, sediment, plants, water. And neptunium is indeed present in all of those at some concentrations in the sediments. And this is in the creeks themselves, so kind of laying around on the mud flats, on the creek floodplain, that kind of stuff. All of this sediment is maybe 100 times elevated in neptunium-237 versus what you could call a global backdrop. It's about 100-fold elevated. And I had said this in 2019 at the original meeting, and I've seen it again. And in our March 2024 sampling, we also went to some upstream and control locations as well. The neptunium is not found in the plants or in the soil or in the water at, say, the village of Piketon boat ramp, which is 5, 6 miles as the crow flies north of the plant. And importantly, it's upriver. It's right along the Scioto River, and it's a good ways upriver of where the contamination is entering into the Scioto.
What is the danger of that level of contamination that you have already found?
Truthfully, I don't know. First of all, I'm not a toxicologist and I'm not prepared or a health physicist or anything like that. I don't have the qualifications to really make that determination or the scientific expertise to do the right experiments, but I can offer some thoughts. You know, it's not a naturally occurring substance in this instance. Its chemical behavior and its radiological behavior as an alpha-emitting isotope is fairly predictable. It emits alpha rays, alpha particles, that is, and it has a 2.1 million year half-life. You know, it's very predictable that way, but very little is known about its chemical toxicity. How does it interact with organisms? How does it interact with DNA? Neptunium in water, in this kind of an environment, forms a relatively soluble species, chemical species meaning chemical form. So it isn't just important that it's neptunium, it's important what chemical form is it in. In this case, in an environment where you have neutral pH or maybe a little bit slightly acidic pH, and that describes this scenario here in the Little Beaver Creek, and you have the presence of some dissolved oxygen, which is true in a creek that's in contact with the atmosphere and soil that's sitting at the surface, neptunium likes to assume the chemical form called neptunyl. I'll spell that, Neptunyl. This stuff is water soluble, and it's not a surprise that neptunium is leaking out of the site in the water. Also, we've talked a little bit before about the on-site waste disposal facility. It's a lined landfill constructed at the northeast corner of the site, and it's to contain all the debris from the demolition of the three process buildings from the former gaseous diffusion plant, and then all the waste from converting the depleted UF6 into new weapons and stuff like that. All that waste is going to have loads of neptunium in it, and at some point in time before 2.14 million years, that landfill is going to fail, and the chemistry of neptunium is bad news for this scenario. It's all going into the aquifer. There's an aquifer underneath this landfill called the Teys, Teays. That's going to happen in time. Also in the landfill, and I'm just talking about neptunium, the whole plant and all of the waste from it and the whole environs is laden with this isotope called technetium-99, or we've talked about this one before. The whole place is soaked with Tech-99, and that includes plants, animals, and people. Water, soil, anything within 10, 15 miles of Portsmouth is just soaked with Tech-99. I haven't done any Tech-99 measurements, but it's apparent from the data. I'm in the business of getting into that. So thanks to ONFN for providing a little bit of funding for NAU student to help me develop a method for measuring Tech-99 in our instrument. So it's not a good scenario, Levy, in Ohio.
Do you know of any way that these radionuclides can be remediated, can be taken out, that the area can be made safe again?
You know, there isn't really a solution for this kind of contamination when it's already out in the environment. You know, the damage is done, the mess was made in the 1970s. But there are things that we can do that are somewhat intelligent responses, and one of them is phytoremediation. Phytoremediation is a term that refers to phyto as plants, the plant kingdom, remediation. The idea here is plants can be used in a remediation strategy. You have to find a plant species that grows fast and is easy to do and can be harvested, and it has a high, it's called the transfer factor or the soil to plant transfer factor, or sometimes it's called the concentration ratio. But basically, you need a plant that has a high propensity to take up the contaminants and get them into the plant tissues. And then for this to do any good in phytoremediation, you need to harvest the plants and take them somewhere else and do something else with it. If you want to remove neptunium or Tech-99 from soil, you can use phytoremediation. You have to grow the plants and then harvest it and take it away. Don't return it to the soil because you're just returning the same elements. Tech-99 and neptunium-237, these are isotopes of elements. They happen to be radioactive. You cannot remediate them into some other element. You can't decompose them into carbon dioxide and water. That's just not feasible. All you can do is physically remove them. or render them in some kind of insoluble, unavailable form, maybe. That still doesn't completely solve the problem. What DOE has been trying to do, apparently, from, and I can garner from reading some of their ACER, annual site environmental monitoring reports, is they put in, they call them permeable barriers. Basically, if you have a region of groundwater contamination that's kind of discharging into a creek, and they know that there are some groundwater contamination areas on the site that basically are discharging into Little Beaver Creek. You know, I've read their reports to the point where it makes sense that I'm detecting what I am in the creek. You can see the pathway is manifest in their report. But they also are trying to put in these permeable barriers that will kind of scrub the contaminant out as the water passes through it. So this strategy is used for things like organic solvents, chlorinated solvents. I know on this portion of the site, there's lots of problems with trichloroethylene, tetrachloroethylene, those kinds of solvents, probably PFAS, although DOE is just dragging their feet like a millipede on doing anything about monitoring PFAS. Secretary Granholm, you are not living up to what you're supposed to do on monitoring PFAS in the environment at Portsmouth or anywhere else in your empire.
And what are PFAS?
PFAS, per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances, these are the so-called forever chemicals that are fluorinated, and the best known examples are a substance called PFOS, PFOS, PFOA. These are among the chemicals that EPA has recently promulgated regulations. There is now a regulation in place that says 4 nanograms per liter is the federal standard for PFOS plus PFOA for drinking water. I can assure you that that DOE site is completely out of compliance. And the Granholm administration knew that going into it and hasn't done a thing. 4 years, 4 years. Anyway, PFAS were made, I guess, famous or notorious in the film Dark Waters with Mark Ruffalo, featuring the protagonist, Rob Ballot, the Cincinnati attorney who brought the suit against DuPont in Parkersburg. PFAS were used in all kinds of industrial ways at the Portsmouth site and at pretty much every other DOE site. In December of 2020, one of the political appointees wrote the various DOE environmental management programs and said, need to start monitoring PFAS. It's written by a Mark Gilbertson. I call it the new sheriff in town letter because it came right after Joe Biden's election was essentially in the bag in December of 2020. So DOE has been out of compliance on that, and they know it. And that's probably at least as serious of a concern as the Neptunium that we're talking about.
For those people who are living in this area, in proximity with it, what, if anything, can and should they be doing to prevent their exposure to this? Or is there any way for them to do this?
People ask me these things, and you know, I think all of us think about limiting our exposure to things, and those of us who are smart about it got really thinking about that in March of 2020 when COVID came along. And in a way, if you live near a site of environmental contamination, you can never completely eliminate all of your exposure, but you can do a number of pretty smart things to limit or curtail your exposure. I mean, you can eliminate quite a few pathways of exposure. So if somebody was living in close proximity to the site, I would tell them, do not grow a garden unless you have testing done on the soil and you establish the levels of radionuclides and you get some serious opinions about is plant uptake of Tech-99 or Neptunium-237 going to be a problem. I would tell them, keep your house tightly sealed. Don't open your windows and use the best air cleaner money can buy indoors. I would also tell them make sure your water supply, particularly if it's not a city water supply, if you have a well, get that checked. Be very wary of spending a lot of time outdoors when the prevailing wind is coming from the DOE reservation right to your house. You know, those would be like my simple tips. And this is common sense. And I'm not talking from the viewpoint of any particular expertise, but I'm just saying this is common sense. If you live there and you wanted to protect yourself and your family, I'd say these are the simple steps. Please do this. And think about moving the hell away because you can't control the air. You really, really can't control the air.
Let's bring this around to Zahn's Corner, which has once more popped up in the news. Recently, and we're talking about in the last week or so, there has been a notice that the former Zahn's Corner Middle School is up for sale. And there's a realtor on it. I saw the offering, and it's fascinating that the offering is very bright and upbeat and positive about the potential. And Barry, somewhere in the middle of it, is saying that the property is being sold as is in capital letters, but they don't mention what the as is. What would be your advice to anyone who might be thinking of putting in a bid and buying this property?
You know, I've always had probably a different opinion about the Zahn's Corner closure, which is now, 5+ years ago. And the building's been sitting there, and I've seen it, the chain link fence around it. I have always thought it was a very odd decision to close the school. My testing showed that there's breadcrumbs from the plant inside the attic. I would say the inference from my data, 2019 data, both from Lamerson samples and Savannah Rivers samples, the inference from my data is that this location has received deposition of contamination from the plant at some point in the past. And if you have spent time at this school in the past, you would have breathed in radioisotopes from the plant while you were here at school. That to me is the appropriate conclusion from my data. It's not an appropriate conclusion from my data to say, oh, well, the whole interior of the school is contaminated, and if we go in there, we're going to all die. That is not true at all. And I am sorry, but so-called anti-nuclear people really misinterpret a lot of things. And this is one case where there is probably no risk whatsoever if you go into that school right now in 2024 on a given day. But what we can never, ever guarantee about that school is the future air quality at that location is tied to what kinds of things DOE is doing in upcoming decades at that Portsmouth plant. And that cannot be controlled. And some of the things they want to do is gear up centrifuge enrichment of uranium. So there's two major activities. Besides the upcoming teardown of the X330 and the X333 building, which will be DOE is trying to do those things in the remainder of the 2020s, DOE and their contractors are starting up the uranium centrifuge plant. And the plan is on site, there are approximately 20,000 14-ton cylinders. This can be seen from an aerial photo. All of them contain depleted uranium in the chemical form of uranium hexafluoride. Uranium hexafluoride is a solid at ambient temperature, but its boiling point is 60 degrees centigrade or 140 Fahrenheit. These things are steel cylinders. They're old. They have valves. They're leaking and they're rusting and they're essentially venting and spewing, and some of them may rupture at some point in time. The government knows that they can't sit there forever, so there is a plan to take that, open them up, convert the uranium hexafluoride into other uranium compounds, eventually making high purity depleted uranium metal. And I say high purity because when they talk about purification or polishing or things like that, removal of impurities, that's needed for weapons. You do not need to do any of those things to make depleted uranium to make a shell to throw at people and kill them. But to make DU depleted uranium to put into weapons components, you need the absolute purest, best stuff. So all of this kind of stuff is on the government's mind. So if I look at a purchaser of this school, I'd say, well, okay, you can go in there today and it's all fine. DOE is not doing anything there. But if Johnny and Janie are in there going to school, and this is 2028, and the wind's blowing while they're demolitioning the 333 building, and the centrifuge plant is fired up and they're cutting open DUF6 cylinders, and the wind is blowing right towards Zahn's. Parents, I can't guarantee anything about what your kids are going to breathe. That's the problem with this location. And really, Libby, it isn't really the problem of the school would be contaminated or where do we build the school. It's more like, where do we build the school? Where could you build the school where you won't have this problem, or will any of your other schools have this problem? My best guess is the conditions are more or less the same. Atmospheric emissions are pretty similar in a pretty broad radius, 10 to 15 miles. DOE has it wrong when they think, oh, it's a 1 or 2 miles, or they start to say you go 6 miles and you don't see anything. It's 10 to 15 miles. Chick Lawson's house, contaminated attic in Lucasville, 10 miles as the crow flies.
So would you advise anyone to purchase that school for any use whatsoever, either as a school or who knows what else it might be?
No, I would not. And I would just say to anybody who lives within 10 to 15 miles of the plant, protect yourself the best you can and think of it as some of the steps that I indicated would be measures that people can take for themselves, and think about moving away. 10 to 15 miles is about how far the air emissions go. So if you're living within that zone and you have a relatively old house, it's permeated into your attic, it's impregnated your soil, and you really ought to think about, does it make sense to be here? One more thing I can say about Zahn's is a parent of one of the students in this Christian Academy that was bidding was a would-be bidder on the purchase of Zahn's. I had a conversation with this person as a result of the media coverage. And I basically, you know, talked through some of the things that we went, you know, of course it's clean today. If you go in there and you test it, we can't ensure the future air quality. We went through all those things. And I basically said, the Academy is currently in Waverly. They're about 6-7 miles north, and they want to move closer to the plant. And I said, you're thinking about moving in the wrong direction. I said, move up towards Chillicothe, which is a city to the north and is about 20 miles north of the Portsmouth DOE reservation. We went through this whole discussion, and this particular parent didn't know a lot of the details. I'll send her an email with a link to your program. And I'd like to think that the negative attention to Zahn's is making people pause. One of the other things that had nothing to do with nuclear contamination that bidders are probably going to realize right away is it's not a residential building. It's sat vacant for 5 years. There's no end to the problems and the liabilities with mold and dust and water damage and buildup of stuff in the ventilation system, the HVAC system, and the plumbing. And the drinking fountains. And I would think it would be several million dollars of some kind of a competent engineering company just to recertify that building for occupancy. I'd say the best thing to be done with it right now is to knock it down. I think symbolically, too, the school board is sending the wrong message. Symbolically, the school board is looking for 30 pieces of silver, just chasing what little money they can get from this. Shame on you.
An announcement on the Pike Christian Academy Facebook site is, after careful consideration and prayer, the school board has decided not to bid on the Zahn's Corner Middle School.
I saw that on Saturday. Almost as soon as it happened, Vina sent me a message.
Michael, who hires you to do this work and who pays your expenses?
Nobody hires me. And I, in a sense, can't really be bought in this line of work. I will share with our listeners that I am supported approximately 50% time, and I'll call it a fellowship. It comes from a private individual through a foundation. And I have basically, we've talked in broad terms, and I have an advisory board, but I have like a carte blanche charter to go and kind of look behind the curtains at all of these sites. And so I make pretty much all decisions about what, when, and where. I work with partners, of course, in figuring out what to do, and I get assistance from people. But I have a modest salary. I have a modest expense budget, and I use the word modest. I'm comfortable. I'm not a very greedy, materialistic person, and I get by very well on how I am doing. And I expect to be continuing with this for about another year and a half. The program that I'm getting the funding for has me kind of chartered to do as I see fit across the country at all sites. And so I'm kind of making all the decisions about, for a place like Piketon, whether to work on it or not, and whom to work with, and what to do, and what kinds of samples to collect, and what kinds of information to generate. I talk with advisors, and you will know some of them, but I mostly make my own decisions about directions.
What other projects or what other areas are you working on right now that you can tell us about?
I'm doing a lot of oversight in many places in the US. In April of this year, I did a news conference with Nuclear Watch New Mexico folks, and I made some public remarks about Los Alamos' databases. And I'm continuing to look at Los Alamos with Jay Coughlin and Scott Kovac and Sophie Stroud of Nuke Watch New Mexico. And I'm also working with the community in the Denver metropolitan area who are pushing back against Rocky Flats. And one of the things I did recently there was with John Lipsky on April 6th, 2024, the Denver area had a horrific windstorm. And we went out to near Rocky Flats and using portable air monitoring equipment that I constructed, we captured some air filter samples. And two of those show the presence of plutonium, essentially contaminated soil blowing off of the former plutonium pit production facility. Essentially, it's leaving federal property and it's going onto non-federal property. And it's essentially moving horizontally. So there's been a lot of things that have happened from there.
And how far away were those samples taken from the boundaries of Rocky Flats?
Where we sampled was to the east of the COU and to the east of the refuge in the immediate downwind location, basically right at the property boundary. We were actually on the county road, and the federal property is like 100 yards to the west of where we were. The winds were a steady 40 mile an hour, gusts up to 70 miles an hour. This place was built in the exact wrong location because of the wind patterns. And so I'm working on that with the local community.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you think is important that you'd like to add at this point?
I'd just like to extend a handout to anybody out there who's listening. If you know of contamination that really needs to see the light of day, let's talk. I am always open to hearing more things. I get all kinds of calls about all kinds of new scenarios. Listeners out there, if you got something that I can help you with that's up the nuclear alley, let's talk.
I will, of course, have your contact information listed on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. And for now, Dr. Michael Ketterer, it's always a stunning experience to talk with you and learn exactly what you are researching, what you are finding, the importance of what you are sharing. And I appreciate you coming again on Nuclear Hot Seat. You've got an open door here. You find anything from the calls that you might be getting from the listeners, you let us know. It'll be on the show. Dr. Michael Ketterer, as always, thank you for being our guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much, Libby. It's always a pleasure.
Dr. Michael Ketterer. We will have his contact information up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 683. And he means it. If you know of any nuclear situation, radiological contamination, anything at all, don't assume he knows. Give him a call, shoot him an email, let him know so he has the chance to do the kind of work that he does, which makes such a difference. We will also have links up to at least two of our previous interviews with Dr. Ketterer, Nuclear Hot Seat number 529 and 597. Check out the webpage and search under his name for even more information on Pike County and more sites.
Activists, shout out.
If you've ever wanted to nominate a laureate, you've got the chance, but time is running out. This is to nominate a laureate to receive the 2025 Nuclear Free Future Award. The deadline for all nominations is September 1st, and laureates will be selected by a jury of their peers. Full disclosure, I was awarded the Nuclear Free Future Award in 2022, and this year I am one of the peers on that jury. In order to nominate someone, go to the NFFA website under this episode and use the form under the Nominations Guidelines tab to submit your nominee. Fill in each section and submit supporting information as a PDF attachment. Nominees must currently be active in opposing nuclear power and/or nuclear weapons and the industries that support them. They should have demonstrated a significant contribution and achievement in one or more of these areas and in one of the three categories of resistance, education, and solution. No self-nominations, please, and each laureate receives a cash prize. So call out any of the hard-working activists you see in your community or on the national or international stage, and I can tell you, it is a thrill, an honor, a joy, and very humbling to receive an award of this sort. Go ahead, make some activists' day. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy for you. Sign up on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase and make it better for us. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for that yellow opt-in box, you really can't miss it, put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will receive one, just one, we don't bug you, but you will get that one important email with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. This way, you never have to miss a single Nuclear Hot Seat ever again. Isn't that remarkable? Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your support and your help. Anything at all, we will really appreciate it. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, number 683, is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is given to the guests, the host, and the program. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only can what you don't know hurt you, chances are it already has. That has been your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.